From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Martin Short. His TV show Primetime Glick begins a new season this weekend on Comedy Central. It's a satire of celebrity interview shows in which Short plays the fawning interviewer of the stars. Also, we talk with British journalist John Ronson. His new book is called Them, Adventures with Extremists. He'll tell us about the time he spent with Omar Bakri Muhammad, an Islamic fundamentalist who has referred to himself as Bin Laden's man in London. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the posthumously released album from Joey Ramone. He was the lead singer of the punk band The Ramones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has denounced the murder of a kidnapped American reporter in Pakistan. Speaking from Beijing, the president said crimes such as the killing of Daniel Pearl will only deepen the U.S. resolve to fight terrorism. The U.S. Embassy in Pakistan confirmed today that the Wall Street Journal reporter was killed by his captors. Pearl was 38. President Bush expressed sympathy for Pearl's family, and especially for his wife, Marianne, who's 7 months pregnant with the couple's first child. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld said the people killed in a raid by U.S. forces last month in Afghanistan were not Taliban or al-Qaeda members, as suspected. But Rumsfeld refused to say that the raid was a mistake. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
On January 23rd, U.S. troops descended on two compounds near Hazar Kadam in Afghanistan that they believed contained Taliban or al-Qaeda forces. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld says the people at one of the compounds fired on the U.S. forces, and 10 to 15 Afghans were killed. He said the deaths were unfortunate, but refused to say that the raid was a mistake.
It is no mistake at all if you're fired on to fire back. And we expect people to defend themselves and to take exactly the action that at least at the moment, I'm aware they took.
U.S. troops captured 27 Afghans in the raid who were questioned and later released. And the U.S. has distributed at least $1,000 in cash to each of the families of those who were killed in the raid. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
United Airlines said today that it's calling 1,200 furloughed flight attendants back to work. The nation's second biggest airline said it needs the additional workers to keep up with an expanding flight schedule in April. The air carrier laid off about 20% of its workforce during the air travel slump that followed the September 11th attacks. Two companies that insured Enron's board members against liability claims are asking a court to rescind their policies. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Enron had taken out insurance policies to protect its board members and officers against personal liability claims in the event they were sued for actions they took on the company's behalf. Now, St. Paul Mercury Insurance Company and Royal Insurance of America say they shouldn't have to pay claims because Enron misrepresented itself when it applied for policies. The companies didn't explain what they meant by those statements. If the court agrees, it would limit the amount of money available to shareholders, creditors, and other people who have sued Enron since its bankruptcy. Meanwhile, a lawyer involved with the case confirms that Enron's auditor, Arthur Anderson, has proposed talks with creditors and shareholders to settle the claims against it. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 106 points to close at 9,834. The Nasdaq lost 59 points. This is NPR News. A federal judge in Cleveland has revoked the American citizenship of John Demjanjuk, the Ukrainian immigrant accused of being a guard in a Nazi death camp during World War II. It's the second time that Demjanjuk's U.S. citizenship has been taken away. The first time was in 1981, before Demjanjuk was tried and sentenced to death in Israel. Demjanjuk's citizenship was restored in 1993 when his Israeli conviction was overturned. Demjanjuk, now 81, is always denied being a death camp guard. He says he was captured while serving in the Soviet Army and spent much of the war as a prisoner. Federal authorities have strengthened security around the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. The FBI says it received information on a possible terrorist threat to the freedom symbol. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
The bell on the colonial buildings on Independence National Historical Park remain open while a regional terrorism task force assessed the credibility of the threat. The FBI won't say what the nature, time frame, or origin of the threat is, but the U.S. Park Service has enhanced security around the national symbol. Security was beefed up at national landmarks around the country after September 11th. Park officials in Philadelphia have worried even more about the Liberty Bell's protection ever since last April when a self-described drifter shouted about God and struck the bell with a small sledgehammer. More than 1.6 million tourists visit the Liberty Bell in Independence Park every year. The bell hasn't been rung since 1864 when it cracked again during a ceremony honoring George Washington's birthday. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Philadelphia.
The recession helped shrink last year's U.S. trade deficit. The Commerce Department said today that the gap between what the U.S. imports from other countries and what it sells abroad was reduced by nearly 8%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, helping feed the more than 31 million Americans at risk of hunger through initiatives such as Campus Kitchen Project, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Short's series, Primetime Glick, begins its new season this Saturday on Comedy Central. The show is a satire of celebrity interview shows. Martin Short got his start doing sketch comedy on SCTV and Saturday Night Live, where he created the characters Ed Grimley, Jackie Rogers Jr., and songwriter Irving Cohn. In a Washington Post review of Primetime Glick, Tom Shales described Glick as the consummate Hollywood hanger-on and fabulous, fatuous phony. And he described Short as a deranged comic genius. In the role of Jiminy Glick, Short looks nothing like himself. He wears a fat suit, has a prosthetic double chin, and looks like he tips the scale at around 300 pounds. The celebrities Glick interviews are real celebrities. Tom Hanks and Ben Stiller appear as themselves in this weekend's edition. Here's Martin Short as Glick with Ben Stiller.
There's so much I want to ask about. There's so much. Your father, let's talk about Jerry Stiller. He's in the wonderful series Queer as Folk.
No.
What series is he in?
You're mistaken. He's on King of Queens.
Oh, that's what they're calling it now.
Yes.
And your mother is Anne Heche, and she's had the worst time of it, hasn't she? She's had this because she thought she was a lesbian.
No.
And then she thought she was a normal person. And then before you know it, she's talking to aliens. How weird is it to be the daughter of clearly someone who's that insane?
I couldn't tell you that because, unfortunately, you've got her mixed up. It's not Anne Heche, it's Anne Mira.
Anne Mira!
Right.
See, I like her better than Anne Heche.
Yes.
Well, no wonder you've got
different.
All that DNA racing for you, all that comedic DNA that's got to be wonderful. Do you have demons, Ben Stiller?
I think we all have demons,
you have
Jiminy.
Demons.
I think we all do.
Martin Short, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with Jiminy Glick. Can you give us like a capsule bio of who this character is?
Jiminy Glick is someone who was privately tutored with his parents until he was around 28. Then he went out into the real world and saw a wonderful production of 40 Carats, touring with Lana Turner, auditioned, got in as onlooker number two, then went to Los Angeles, where for 6 years he worked at Chasen's as a busboy. And at one night catering a party at Roddy McDowell's, the very drunken George Schlatter was helped home, declaring that a host for a syndicated show that he wanted had walked out because they didn't accept George's double scale approach. And after that, the rest is history. I was asked to do the show, and before you know it, I'm suddenly talking to the likes of yous.
Why is it so important for Jiminy Glick to always be in touch with celebrities?
I don't know. I think that Jiminy is someone who thrives on this shallow world of celebrity. When I started the show and then it went on the air, and then I would read some response to it, only the positive, of course, that would claim great, you know, declarations of intent, you know, the ultimate satire of a form of a blanket of blank. And I would just say, absolutely. But it's not always true. Sometimes you set up by just saying that this character, if you met him in life, whether he was a teacher or whether he was a politician or whether he was a celebrity interviewer, would make you laugh because of his strange, sincere take on the world and how wrong it is.
And he has a great mix of self-involvement and insecurity.
Right. Where I can laugh at Jiminy objectively is when he gets very sincere and feels he's doing a hard-hitting, tough interview. And the finger is pointing. And he says in the show, which is, I think, with Dave Duchovny airing in a week or so, he says, I worry about Robert Downey. Do you worry about Robert Downey? And Duchovny says, yes. He says, I feel like cornering him and saying, Bobby, stop it and stay stopped it. And Duchovny says, I think that's what he needs. He needs someone to point their finger at him and say, stay stopped. And in Jiminy's world, he thinks he's doing exactly what Charlie Rose would do.
Right. No. One of Jiminy Glick's trademarks is that he's very self-absorbed. So when he's interviewing a celebrity, he's also talking about himself a lot and talking about his adventures with other celebrities and,
right.
and his wife and his past. Have you met a lot of interviewers like that where it seems to be more about them than it is about you?
I was interviewed once for a show, and I'm not going to say who it was because he's kind of known, and you, it seems to me, but he would end up talking about himself to the degree that I in my mind I was thinking it's been about 4 minutes since I've spoken. And it was an interview not unlike this where it was just, you know, supposed to be an interview with me.
So what did that bring out in you?
I truthfully, it brings out no reaction other than laughter, whether I can laugh then or laugh later. You know, I think that the funniest character work is out there in life. Whether you go to the cleaners or whether you go to a restaurant or whoever you might meet, it's just astounding how funny the people are. And sometimes I'll see situations, I'll be in situations, I'll look at someone and I'll think, you know, if this were a sketch, you'd say too broad. It'd bring down the glasses, you don't need that funny dress, you don't need that funny suit, you know. And yet here it is, it's life. So in those situations, I just kind of make a mental note and think I'll use it somewhere.
Now, one of the things that the Jiminy Glick show does is break for commercials, as most broadcast shows do, but these are all satirical commercials. I thought maybe we could break for one of your commercials from Primetime Glick, and this is a commercial for the Independent Film Channel.
This Monday on the Independent Movie Channel's Best of the Fest, Robin Herker's Explaining Carlo. The explosive story of two young heroin addicts who drive cross-country and strike up a relationship with two Texas lesbians. Then on Tuesday, two different lesbians on their way to L.A. strike up a relationship with a heroin-addicted ex-security guard from Texas in Kira Sandoval's controversial The Wisdom of Sarah Finkelman. Then on Wednesday, two ex-lesbians are drawn back into their former lifestyle when they pick up three heroin-addicted hitchhikers.
That's one of the very funny satirical commercials from Martin Short's show, Prime Time Glick. Do you write any of those commercials yourself?
Yes.
Good. They're very funny.
Yeah. Well, I work with two brilliant guys. One is Michael Short and one is Paul Flaherty. And the three of us create the show together.
Is Michael Short a relation?
Yes, he's a brother.
Uh-huh.
And my big brother, Mike.
Is Paul Flaherty related to
Joe Flaherty,
Joe
brother.
Joe Flaherty, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, wow. All in the family.
They're all obviously I grew up with Michael, but I met Paul on SCTV, which Michael also wrote.
Mm-hmm. Are your interviews on Primetime Glick scripted? When you have on real celebrities and you're playing this satire of a celebrity interviewer, do the real celebrities know what you're going to ask in advance, and have they already had a chance to think through how they're going to respond?
No, none of it is planned, and none of it's scripted. No one knows what I'm going to say, and I don't know what I'm going to say. I have pages in front of me that have facts about the celebrity, and often I won't even look at it until the last second because Jiminy wouldn't look at it till the last second.
Right, and you have a way of choosing choosing the most unimportant movie that an actor's made to zero in on. Sometimes when you have an actor on the show who you're interviewing, they're clearly like trying to not totally crack up because mm-hmm. they think what you're doing is really funny, but they want to stay in character as if this was a real show.
Right.
Do you advise them not to laugh if at all possible?
No, what we used to, I know that when in last season when we were cutting some of the early shows, I was very self-conscious about them laughing. It seemed kind of cheesy to me that I would be executive producing the show that has people sitting back going, oh, Marty, how can I get through this? It felt a little self-serving. Then, as I would look at it again, I'd think, you know, I'm wrong. It's just, it's natural, that it's fun. It's not an indictment either way. And everyone has a kind of a different approach. Some come with an agenda. I interviewed George Segal once, and we got into a fight. A mock fight, but it wasn't planned. So some of these things, particularly if you're working with people from an improvisational background, can go many different directions.
Now, you've said that when you were a kid, you really, you know, wanted to be a celebrity yourself. So do you feel like on some level you really understand Jiminy Glick's need to be famous and to be with famous people?
Well, I don't know if he needs to be with famous people as much as that for Jiminy, these shallow tidbits that make up his life are important. They're fascinating. But more importantly, society has rewarded him. He does have his own show. He does live in a nice house. He is watched. And he couldn't be less qualified to be in his position. He's not the only person in the entertainment world that has that position.
My guest is Martin Short. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Short. His TV series Primetime Glick is on Comedy Central. Now, I know you did imaginary TV shows when you were a kid. Were any of them interview shows where you got to interview the guests?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Well, there were variety. Variety interview, you know. I'd come out, sing a few numbers. I had, you know, a huge orchestra. And then I would sit down. I would get, you know, Playboy magazine, and I would, you know, read the interview with, I don't know, Norman Lear, and I do both voices. So I do a hard-hitting interview in the midst of, you know, doing a medley of songs that weren't nominated or something.
So when you were young and you were watching all these TV shows and doing your imaginary show, did you have any training? Did your mother say, send this boy to acting school or give him singing lessons, develop that talent?
No. My mother was the concert mistress of the symphony. She was the first female concertmaster, actually. So I grew up with, at times during the season, 5 hours of practice heard within the house on a violin. So the idea of rehearsal and opening night was not foreign. But no, I think growing up in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, you don't instinctively, Broadway isn't down the street, so it all seems not terribly realistic. I took piano lessons, but I never stated I was going to be an actor. It wasn't a realistic declaration, and I was always drawn toward, reality in that respect. So it wasn't until I was in university and having done theater throughout university, realized that there was actually an acting scene in Toronto, Ontario, which was 40 miles away. And that it was not inconceivable to take a year off school and try it.
Did your mother measure talent according to more classical standards of rigorous studies and a more legit kind of singing voice than you probably had? You had a more pop voice.
No, you know what? It was very interesting. She was always very encouraging. In fact, I have, when I was 15, Frank Sinatra had released an album called September of My Years. And I re-recorded that. I typed all the lyrics, and I had an attic bedroom, and the hallway to the bedroom was kind of had an echo to it. So I set up my chair. I had a microphone, reel to reel, and I would play the introductions from the Sinatra album, But it would be, and of course, Frank was, you know, 53 and I was 14. But the introductions would be in his key, so it'd be do 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 moon do 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 moon do 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 do, and you hear click. Strangers in the night, too long. I was in Frank's keys. But I would do the album, and it would take me about a week, you know. I'd make up an album cover, and then my mother, I remember, listened to it and critiqued it because she used to adjudicate at certain, you know, violin contests and things in her life, and so she wrote a synopsis of a critique of each song, and this the pitch was very good, lovely old song, well phrased at the end, hold the note too long here. And rated on a 4 stars, 3 stars, 3.5 stars, you know. So I still have that.
Wait, was that helpful?
It was helpful. I think it was mainly helpful because someone was taking my fantasy world very seriously and treating it with credibility and respect. You know, Frank Sinatra once said that his father was always around to piss on his dreams. And I think it's very important for parents to constantly nurture and support eclectic interests of their children, because you never know which one is going to develop, become the fuel that, you know, drives their life.
So I know that when you went to college, you studied, what, social welfare for the
first? No, I started off in pre-meds. I was going to be a doctor.
Huh.
And I did that for 2 years, and I switched to a social work course.
So when did you decide to try acting?
It's the end of my 4th year at college, and I was about to do a master's, and I thought, I had just done constant theater, and it was for non-credit at McMaster University where I went. So Eugene Levy, I remember, who lived in Toronto at that time, struggling actor, said, you know, you should try this and you know, encourage me to try it. And I did. But I was very determined. You know, it was 1 year in my brain. I was going to do it for 1 year. And at the end of that 1 year, I wasn't making a living. Then I was back to school. I didn't want to be trapped or caught, you know, at 30 in a profession that wasn't going to give me confidence.
And is this when you were in Godspell?
The first show that I got was show Godspell, which was the big show in Toronto, and everyone wanted it, and 1,000 people auditioned, etc. And I got it. And I was still in university. I was still finishing my 4th year, so I was ahead of my plan, you know. And it was a remarkable time. It was the first time I wasn't in school. It was the first time that I was getting an income. I was now doing this play every night, this musical that was so much fun, and meeting great people that would become my friends for my whole life. You know, Paul Schaefer was the musical director of Godspell, and it was a first-time show for Gilda Radner, and you know, Eugene got it, and I got it, and Dave Thomas would later come into it, and Andrea Martin, and it was astounding. It's only a cast of 10.
How much TV do you watch? What shows do you watch the most?
I don't watch much TV at all, I must say, you know, which I don't say proudly, or aren't I something great? I just, you know, it seems like I get home, I have dinner, there are conversations, I have 3 children and a wife, there's running around for the kids, there is, and then all of a sudden if it's 8:30, we might watch a movie. Now it's amazing. They'll have anniversary shows for series that were on, you know, for 10 years, and then now they're back for an anniversary show. I never saw any of the episodes. I'll read TV Guide and I'll get a sense of the land, the lay of the land. And if, you know, a show has been in the top 10 for a certain amount of time, then I will literally set the timer and watch it that way.
Getting back to the to Primetime Glick. Jiminy Glick has a sidekick and band leader whose name is Adrian Van Voorhees, a great name, I have to say, and he plays harp. Michael McKean plays the character. Can you talk about coming up with this character?
Well, I certainly didn't come up with the character Michael did, but we kind of wrote it in a direction. It was you kind of find that the more things you do with characters, the more you come up with it. We'd be writing something, and Michael would come in, and he'd say, Michael said, you know, I want to play him like he's older, but he wears a lot of makeup to hide it. So that becomes part of the character. Is he married? We discussed. Yeah, he's married 4 times, no children, Michael said one day. So that becomes part of the character.
Mm-hmm.
Does he like Jiminy? He doesn't dislike Jiminy, but it's a job. So if Jiminy insults him or cuts him off, he goes, very good, no problem, because it's a job. One of the episodes, his first wife, who's around 85, is on. It's one of those scenarios where we assume that he's married. His first wife was 20 years older. She's a horn player, and he just loses it. And there's a tape of Buddy Rich, pirated tape of Buddy Rich screaming at the band on a bus. Wants his band, and so we made that Adrian Van Voorhees. So we come back from commercial, and he's just berating. Clams, you're hitting nothing but clams, you know. And so that's a new side of Adrian, the side of Adrian losing it. So that's what makes that stuff fun, is you keep saying, what if Adrian, you know, was in a bad mood this show, or what if Adrian gets hurt? I interviewed Michael last year, Michael McKean, as Adrian, and the idea was that Russell Crowe hadn't shown up, and now we had to interview Adrian Van Voorhees. And at one point, again, it's all improvised, I asked him something about, I made some comment about the fact that he wasn't terribly educated, that was that ever a limitation as a musician? And Michael's face completely changed, and he started to tear up, real tears. And there was a split second that even I, as Jiminy, thought, wait a second, have I mentioned something that's actually gotten Michael upset? I mean, it was so real. And he then proceeded to let me know, as Adrian Van Voorhees, that this was a very hurtful subject for him, and I could be hurtful sometimes and insensitive. And that he was always, you know, it was a sore spot for him, his lack of education. And it was an amazing exercise to watch, even after all these years of improvising, to see someone that into it and to make it that real.
So how did your character, Jiminy Glick, react when...
He became very, oh my God, Adrian, I so didn't mean that. I mean, he became a little bit attentive to the possibility that he'd gone too far. You know, Jiminy Glick has no intention of hurting anyone. And when people get upset, when they walk off or they storm out, what have I done? Someone explain to me what I have done. He doesn't know.
Well, Martin Short, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Martin Short's TV series, Primetime Glick, begins a new season this Saturday evening on Comedy Central. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of WITSIC, Inside the Witness Protection Program by Pete Early and Gerald Scher, founder of WITSIC. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the man who declared holy war on Britain. We speak with journalist John Ronson. His new book, Them, is about extremists. He'll tell us about spending time with Omar Bakri Muhammad. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Don't Worry About Me, a new posthumously released CD by Joey Ramone.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joey Ramone, the lead singer of the seminal 70s punk rock band The Ramones, died last April of lymphatic cancer. He was 49. In the months preceding his death, he recorded numerous tracks for a solo album that has now been released under the title Don't Worry About Me. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Hearing Joey Ramone sing a typically out-of-tune but in-the-zone version of the Louis Armstrong hit What a Wonderful World is now a little sad, a little ironic, and thankfully pretty exhilarating and funny. Recording the song, which leads off his posthumous album, was Joey's way of saying that he had a heart despite his punk cynicism. It was also part of his never-ending quest to score a hit record, or at least a song that would get some radio airplay.
Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Stop thinking about it. Obsessing, don't you know what this is? Yeah, you don't know what you want, but you want it. Stop thinking about it.
There's a typical Ramones song, fast and blunt, unrelenting in its adherence to a single riff and a catchy chorus. Working with his longtime producer Daniel Ray, Joey obviously wasn't interested in disturbing his career-long musical strategy. Indeed, in their later years, the Ramones achieved their greatest success as a nostalgia act, a living reenactment of classic 70s punk rock. This development may have fattened Joey's bank account a bit, but it was bittersweet recognition. The Ramones formed initially as a reaction to 70s corporate and art rock, everything from the Eagles and Peter Frampton to REO Speedwagon and Yes. Joey thought his band's music wasn't radical at all, but rather a return to old-school basics. Yes, they were brats who celebrated sniffing glue, but there was a melancholy in Joey's dolorous voice that always lent even the most goofy or misguided music some poignance. And for a guy who used to sing about the joys of being sedated, it's striking to hear him lament his cancerous condition and utter unambiguously the words, "I want my life," on this song called "I Got Knocked Down, But I'll Get Up." It may be the biggest irony of Joey Ramone's life and death that his band, which spent its existence reacting against the most entrenched conventions of rock music, is going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next month. I'll bet if he showed up for the ceremony at all, he'd have had a few withering, if hopelessly mumbled, words for all those rock industry insiders who'd done their best to ignore the Ramones when they were in peak condition.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Joey Ramone's posthumously released CD, Don't Worry About Me.
Thanks.
Coming up, Adventures with Extremists. This is Fresh Air. British journalist John Ronson wanted to know what makes extremists tick and what makes conspiracy theorists believe that a shadowy elite secretly rules the world. So he spent time with neo-Nazis, religious extremists, and New World Order conspiracy theorists. His new book is called Them, Adventures with Extremists. As part of Ronson's research, he spent a year around Omar Bakri Muhammad, who before September 11th had described himself as Bin Laden's man in London and had declared holy war on Britain. Yet he seemed kind of clownish to Ronson. Omar was born into a wealthy family in Syria. In his teens, he moved to Saudi Arabia to preach jihad on university campuses. After hearing he would be arrested, he went to England. I asked John Ronson how he got close enough to Omar Bakri Muhammad to see what he was like.
I just called him up, and he said, oh, yes, please do come over. The first thing he said to me was, I am actually very nice, you know. And I said, are you? And he said, oh, yes, I am delightful. So I went to his house, and the first thing we did was watch The Lion King, which is the only way he can relax. He said he watches The Lion King every night while he was bouncing his baby daughter up and down on his knee. Singing along to Hakuna Matata, which was the only way he could relax. So immediately he became very surprising. I asked him his daughter's name, and he said that his baby daughter's name, when translated into English, is the Black Flag of Islam. And I said, really, your baby daughter's called the Black Flag of Islam? And he said, yes. And I said, really? And he said, you see now why our cultures can never integrate? So right from the beginning, Omar was playfully teaching me how his views of the world, you know, his view, his segregation, separation and so on. He was kind of playfully giving me a lecture in those things.
The way you portray him in your book, he seems almost more like an absent-minded kook than a serious threat. What were some of the ways in which he came off to you as kind of absent-minded and goofy?
Yeah, which is always surprising. You know, after September the 11th, and then more recently, it's been said that the shoe bomber Richard Reid was radicalised by Omar, and some of the British extremists at Camp X-Ray had been radicalised by Omar. And I thought to myself, well, Omar always portrayed himself as a laughable clown, really, a buffoon. Is this the same Omar? Is this the same guy who radicalised Richard Reid? And I thought, well, yes, it is the same person. So maybe the way he behaved towards Richard Reid was the same way as how he behaved towards me.
Well, how did he behave towards you?
Kind of silly and clownish and funny and absurd. Now, I've been accused of poking fun at these people, which is not something I think I do. I think, you know, one of the things I like most about human beings is our capacity to be absurd, and so I really liked Omar's absurdity. It was very recognisable. It was a recognisable human characteristic. He was kind of silly. On our first day together, he was handing out leaflets saying, you know, death to homosexuals, you know, homosexuality is the deadly disease, and he was handing out these leaflets and yelling, homosexuality, the deadly disease, homosexuality, and nobody would take a leaflet. So he was adapting his technique, and he was saying, you know, beware from homosexuality, there are homosexuals everywhere, and still nobody would take a leaflet. But people weren't attacking him. They were kind of smiling. The passers-by were kind of smiling benignly at him. And then finally he told me he had a good idea, and he turned over the leaflets and said, "Help the orphans, help the orphans." And so people began to accept the leaflets, and he said to me, "Oh, this is good, this is good. You know, John, if I wasn't a Muslim, I'd be working for, how you say, Saatchi and Saatchi." So Omar had a great understanding of our world, but at the same time was trying to destroy it.
Another way he was just trying to destroy the world is, I mean, he loved being in Britain, having its free speech. He could speak at Trafalgar Square. He could hand out his leaflets. He could preach the overthrow of Britain and the creation of an Islamic state. And, you know,
and we just let him.
And everyone would just let him. Free speech. But he was using that free speech to destroy. His goal ultimately would be to destroy free speech.
And the irony wasn't lost on him. He always got his leaflets photocopied at Officeworld because of their special price promise that if you find a photocopying service that's cheaper, then Officeworld will give you a discount. And when he told me that, I just said, "Well, that's capitalism." He goes, "Oh, yes, I benefit from your capitalism to convey the message." And he'd always laugh about it. You know, "Oh, what's going to happen to me here?" He used to be very thin, you see, and swarthy and good-looking, but now he lives in Britain, he's fat. And he'd say to me, "Well, of course I got fat, because what's going to happen to me here?" So I got fat. You know, when I was living in Saudi Arabia or Syria, I was always on the run. But no, nothing's going to happen to me here, so I got fat. So he was kind of laughing at us.
You went with the Sheikh to a jihad training camp. Did you know that that's where he was taking you?
Yeah, he kept on mentioning his jihad training camp to me. And I kept saying, "Well, can I come? Will you bring me?" And he'd go, no. And then after a little while, he finally relented. And I said, "Well, where is this jihad training camp?" And he said, "It's in Crawley." Now, Crawley is a very anonymous commuter town near Gatwick Airport. It's really the last place in the world you'd expect to find a jihad training camp. So I went there with him. And it turned out to be a scout hut, a kind of well-stocked scout hut in the middle of a forestry centre. And all these young jihad trainees, I guess, were kind of beating the punch bag and so on. And the thing I remember most about our time at the jihad training camp was Omar suddenly announcing, he hushed the room and said, "Look at me," he said, "look at me with an infidel, look at me with John, who is a Jew." And the whole room went, and I had no idea that Omar knew I was Jewish. I'd kind of hidden my Jewishness from him. The whole room gasped, and then the voice from the... Well, I said, "Well, surely it's better to be a Jew than an atheist." And this voice from the crowd said, "No, it isn't." And then Omar started lecturing me in front of the room. You know, "Why do you hide it? Why do you lie? Why do you hide it? You know, be proud to be a Jew. Are you a Zionist?" And I kind of said, "Not really." Yeah. And he said, "Well, if you're a Zionist, that's different. But, you know, be proud, be a Jew." And then they all surrounded me, these young... Because they'd never met a Jew before. And obviously I was fearful that they'd attack me. But in fact, I think they treated me like a tropical fish you'd find in a coral reef. You know, this kind of strange, slightly frightening, colourful presence. And they just kind of surrounded me and just asked me lots of questions about what it's like to be a Jew. And you know... And at the end, I kind of figured it worked out okay, because at the end, I left with him thinking, well, he was okay, so maybe the Jews are okay.
Okay, so you were able to go with an extremist Islamic sheikh who made his home in England. You were able to go with him to a jihad training camp in England and meet a bunch of young Islamic extremists in training who hated Jews. And leave thinking, well, that was a kind of interesting experience. And then September 11th happens. After September 11th, did you rethink all the experiences that you had had with the Sheikh?
Well, my first thought was that somehow maybe these things weren't true. And then I thought, well, actually...
Which things weren't true?
Well, that there was something fake about my relationship with Omar. Maybe he was putting it on. Maybe he was a monster disguising himself as a laughable buffoon. But then I thought, well, it is all true. Everything that happened my year with Omar, and I spent a whole year with him, you know, chauffeuring him about and so on. And it all happened. And then I thought, well, the way that I portray Omar in the chapter is an accurate portrayal of him. And I think it troubles some people that I portray him as a, you know, I portray him humanely, I think, and I portray him as a human being and silly and laughable, and I portray him in all these incongruous ways. And maybe the disquieting thing about it is that in the light of September the 11th, it's easy and possibly accurate in some ways to portray these people as one-dimensional demons. Maybe this portrayal of him as a human being with all the human frailties and the absurdity of a human being is a more, you know, uncomfortably accurate portrayal of him. And of course, Omar Bakri isn't Osama bin Laden.
If you're just joining us, my guest is British journalist John Ronson. His new book is called Them, Adventures with Extremists. Now, the Sheikh used to brag about knowing a lot of the big men in Islamic extremism, including Osama bin Laden. And again, this was before September 11th. How did bin Laden sound to you from the Sheikh's descriptions of him?
Oh, he's a charismatic, warm man with amazing, penetrating blue eyes. It's funny, when you watch that video of bin Laden talking to the Saudi Arabian mullah, it's the thing I found interesting about that is the human interaction, the interaction between the two of them. You had this mullah kind of giggling like a schoolgirl on meeting Britney Spears, and bin Laden acting like this kind of munificent, benevolent leader, this king, this highly charismatic man. And that's certainly how Omar portrayed him to me, as this kindly. And they were all impressed. They were hugely impressed about the fact that here was a multimillionaire who lived in a cave, even though I have my inkling that bin Laden doesn't actually live in a cave, because if he did, his fingernails wouldn't be that good. So it's the sacrifice, it's the financial sacrifices that bin Laden made, I think, make him so appealing to people. And that's certainly the way Omar portrayed him.
What were Sheikh Omar Bakri's public comments about the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon?
Delight. He said he was delighted and excited by the attacks. And that somebody had telephoned him and said the United States has come under attack. And he said, this is so exciting. And then he was arrested, but they released him that night because he hadn't committed any crime. Being delighted wasn't a crime. What I found interesting about Omar around then was that in public he was showing great bravado and joy, but in private he seemed very scared. I'd be talking to him on the phone and he'd say to me, oh, John, this is terrible. They say they may deport me. They're calling me bin Laden's man in Great Britain. Why are they calling me bin Laden's man in Great Britain? And I would say, well, because you've been calling yourself bin Laden's man in Great Britain for years, Omar. And he said, oh, John, why don't people believe you when you tell them that I'm just a harmless clown? You know I'm just a harmless clown, don't you, John? So it was a kind of interesting, the way Omar was responding was really interesting, because you'd think that somebody would be contrite and apologetic and soft in public and then full of great bravado in private. But Omar was actually doing the opposite.
My guest is British journalist John Ronson. His new book is called Them, Adventures with Extremists. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is British journalist John Ronson. His new book, Them, profiles extremists and conspiracy theorists. The first chapter is devoted to Omar Bakri Muhammad, an Islamic extremist based in London, who before September 11th preached holy war on Britain. What are Sheikh Omar Bakri's reactions to the way you have portrayed him?
Well, it changes. In public, he's always been outraged. I'm the Zionist pig. He tried to demonize me, but that failed, so instead he ridiculed me, which I don't believe I've ever done. I don't think I ridicule anybody in the book. I think, as I say, I portray them sometimes as absurd and funny, but, you know, I think being absurd and unintentionally funny is something that's good about human nature. I'm glad we have that capacity for being absurd. So in public, Omar always responds like that. And in private, it varies. Sometimes I phone him up and he goes, "Oh, John, it's so lovely to hear from you. How is my friend John?" Then other times I telephone him and he says, "Yes, what do you want? John Ronson, what do you want?" And I figure that the times when he's like that is because there's other people in the room. But at the time, he really he liked it. He liked being portrayed as a human being.
You said that one of the things you wanted to do with your book, Them, Adventures with Extremists, is to see our world through the eyes of extremists, to see how do they see us. So what did you learn from spending a year with Sheikh Omar Bakri about how he, as an Islamic extremist cleric, sees you or your country or the United States?
A lot of the extremists that I spent time with had absurd conspiracy theories that Henry Kissinger transformed himself into a 12-foot lizard. Kind of ludicrous things. They were kind of almost talking in metaphors. But Omar Bakri would say, "Well, look, here is a 12-year-old Palestinian boy hiding behind his father's back for safety. And he's, look, there he is getting shot by the Israeli army now." So it was very hard to, laugh at Omar's portrayal of the Western world and what he saw as a pact between the Zionists and the United States and Great Britain. And of course, he saw how he was demonized, how he was the most dangerous man in Britain. And he found that funny, but it made me feel how we need to have these monsters living amongst us. At the time, Omar wasn't particularly monstrous. He was just silly, but we like to portray him as a monster.
Do you think he got more power through that portrayal as being a monster?
Oh, certainly. He loved to be portrayed as this evil man. He'd say to me, this is great, this is great. There was one time when the Observer newspaper wanted to take his photograph, so he was standing there smiling. And they'd go, "No, no, don't smile," they'd say. They said to him, say cheese, say tease. And he said, "What, you want me to show my teeth? And then you want me to do this for you?" And he kind of gnarled his fingers like a Nosferatu vampire. And they took a photograph of him and they printed it in the newspaper. And he said, I was joking with them. And look what they do. But he loved it because, of course, the Observer says he's the most dangerous man in Britain. And people say, well, he sounds very interesting. We should study with his group. So, of course, he loved that portrayal. It works both ways, you see. The demonization works both ways.
But maybe he really was the most dangerous man in Britain, in part because he knew bin Laden and he knew all the other major Islamic extremists, and he had his own training school in England, and he was doing a decent job of training recruits for jihad. So maybe you were the one who got it wrong. Maybe he really was dangerous, and you missed that.
Well, I don't think I don't portray him as dangerous. I think I portray him as complex. And towards the end of the book, he was putting up posters saying the final hour will not come until the Muslims kill the Jews, and his cell phone number was at the bottom of the posters. So I don't think I portrayed Omar just as a joker. I think I portrayed him accurately as the complicated mixture of the burlesque and the chilling that he actually is.
John Ronson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
John Ronson is the author of the new book, Them, Adventures with Extremists. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We close on a sad note today with the news of the death of someone very important in the public radio world, Rick Madden. He was the founding director of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Radio Program Fund. He played a major role in the creation of many radio programs, including the national launch of Fresh Air. Last May, he won public radio's highest honor, the Edward R. Murrow Award. The president of CPB, Bob Coonrod, said, "Madden personified public radio. He pushed it to pursue larger imperatives, to do more for more people. He celebrated radio's mission and took tremendous pride in its public purpose." We'll close with music Rick loved, Gilbert and Sullivan.
On this subject I pray you be dumb. Your notions, though many, are not worth a penny. The word for your guidance is mum. You've a very good bargain in me.
On this subject I pray you be dumb. We think you had better succumb. You'll find here a penny will get to a penny, will get to a penny. The lots of fish you'll see, there are lots of fish you'll see. There are lots of fish you'll see, there are lots of fish you'll see. There are lots of fish you'll see, in the sea, in the sea, in the sea, in the sea.
The threatened cloud has passed away. What though the night may come too soon?
We hear the bells
of afternoon. The
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the World of the Disabled, a work of nonfiction by Andrew Potok. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Johnny Cash turns 70 next week. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with him. Also, we hear from Irish writer Nuala O'Fuaillon. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tide.